Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Zachary Muggy. Otto Hilbert is with me, and together we represent Christopher Clark, who's in attendance this afternoon. Your Honors, the issue to be decided in this case is whether a mistake made by a state trooper in the field should trump the public policy goals of the Colorado legislature. Now, when we boil the issue in this case down to those sort of simplistic terms, the answer seems obvious. No. A mistake made by a field officer should not trump the entire public policy goals of the Colorado legislature. That's exactly the scenario we have in this case. The trial court below adopted an interpretation of CRS 2472-308, which permits the sealing of criminal records. And the trial court interpreted that statute to mean that a mistake made by the state trooper who brought a mistaken charge against Mr. Clark should trump and entirely defeat the public policy goals of the state legislature, which allows the Colorado citizens to petition a court to have their criminal records sealed when their privacy harms and their unwarranted adverse consequences to them outweigh the public's interest in keeping those criminal records open. We've brought this appeal, Mr. Clark has brought this appeal today to seek reversal of the trial court's interpretation of CRS 2472-308.
Now, Mr. Muggy, yes. Let me just clarify something. Any alleged mistake as to the charge here, isn't that Mr. Clark's fault? Because he said he was the driver? And how can that be put on the state? That's Mr. Clark's fault.
It's a fair question, Your Honor, but no, he corrected the misstatement before any of those charges were ever brought against him by the state trooper at the scene of the accident.
Well, but how would the state trooper know which time he was telling the truth?
Well, the fact remains that he wasn't the driver of the vehicle. It's undisputed.
But at the time the ticket is written, how's the state trooper to know? I mean, it's just as likely that he's not telling the truth the second time as that he was not telling the truth the first time.
Well, actually, isn't it more likely? He's the only one at the scene.
No, Your Honor, his son came back, and the state trooper actually had a report from another passerby who called in the accident to begin with, who confirmed that his son, Jeffrey, was in fact the driver of the vehicle. Mr. Clark immediately corrected himself, so there was no confusion. This was a big mistake. There was confusion at the time. The vehicle was ruled. It was a one-car accident. There were no injuries, and it was a mistake, ultimately recognized by the DA. Who dismissed the charge outright, recognizing that he was not the driver of the vehicle and therefore had no duty to report the accident. The DA then charged him with a higher charge, a Class 3 misdemeanor under the Colorado Criminal Code as opposed to the traffic code. So there is no confusion on that issue.
Well, Mr. Muggy, let me ask you this. Someone who's been charged with a traffic offense and had went to trial and was acquitted could also say that he should never have been charged with the crime, correct?
Correct.
But that person cannot get their file expunged. Why should your client wind up in a better situation than that person?
Well, it's not a better situation, Your Honor, but it's undisputed that he was charged subsequently with a higher crime, as I just said, under the criminal code.
Well, it is a better situation if your client manages to get the file sealed, whereas somebody who was actually acquitted would not be able to. That is a better situation, wouldn't you agree?
In this case, I would not, Your Honor. I understand the court's point, but Mr. Clark was subsequently charged with false reporting as opposed to failure to report.
Well, that's because he did a plea bargain, correct?
It wasn't a plea bargain, Your Honor. I mean, it wasn't a plea to accept a higher charge. I mean, the DA essentially corrected the mistake, recognizing that he wasn't the driver, and then dismissed that charge entirely, then charged him with the false reporting charge. So it wasn't a traditional plea bargain. In that sense,
was this done in more than one step? My understanding was there was a dismissal, simultaneously a substitution of a new charge to which Mr. Clark agreed to plead guilty. How is that not a plea bargain?
Well, because I think, Your Honor, a plea bargain would be accepting a lesser charge, to the same classification, the same traffic related offense, than to a charge under the criminal code, which, you know, is a higher charge. So I don't think it was a plea bargain. I think it was just a correction. They dismissed one charge and imposed the proper charge to which he pled guilty, wanting to end the whole situation and put it behind him. So Mr. Clark is a securities broker, and securities brokers are subject to very intense and heightened public disclosure requirements. And those are very important facts to remember in this case, because Mr. Clark was forced to, not forced, but during a public, during a review of his license, he had to disclose these charges. And in doing so, Wachovia and FINRA instituted an investigation into the charges and eventually suspended his securities license for approximately 4 months. It was during that time that he went back, hired a lawyer, met with the DA, and the DA agreed to allow him to withdraw his guilty plea to the false reporting charge.
Counsel, I'm aware that this is not central to your argument, but I'm just curious on this point. Would it be your position that your client would not have to disclose the false reporting charge if the record had been sealed?
Correct.
So in your view, sealing means you can essentially pretend it never happened.
I wouldn't put it in those terms, Your Honor, but within the FINRA regulations and the regulations from his employer, he would at that time be permitted to not disclose that on his public disclosure requirements.
Thank you.
And that's really what the concern is. So as I said, he was allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. At the time, the people agreed that the harm to his privacy interests and the unwarranted adverse consequences to his professional life greatly outweighed any public interest in maintaining the openness of these two dismissed charges, as they had absolutely nothing to do with his work as a securities broker. Mr. Clark then filed his petition to seal. At the outset, the court found that his petition was sufficient on its face and that there were no grounds to deny the application. At the time, the people agreed to the sealing of his records. A hearing was held, and at that time, the court recognized the exception delineated in 2472-308-3A, which prohibits the sealing of criminal records in classes, class 1 and class 2 traffic misdemeanors. And this has been where the case is bogged down. The trial court recognized the inequities involved, recognized that it was a mistaken charge, asked the parties to try and find a resolution, and ultimately the court found that its hands were tied by the statutory language.
Assuming, counsel, for the sake of argument, that we agree with you and conclude that the statute is not a bar to sealing, do you agree that the matter must be remanded to the court for a formal balancing, which may in fact be a very quick proceeding because the people may concede the point, but in any event, you would agree that the court did not actually conduct that inquiry and didn't formally balance and pronounce a decision on that point?
Your Honor, it's a good question, but I think one that's already been resolved. The people actually did already agree and consented on the record through pleadings filed in that court that the privacy harms and unwarranted adverse consequences did greatly outweigh.
But does that end the court's inquiry? Are the court's hands tied on that point? Is the court not free to disagree with the people on that
point?
Well,
it's a good question, Your Honor. I think the court has already agreed with that, though, and already made a determination that certainly that's the case, that this is the very...
Oh, so the court made a finding on this point?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have the record in front of me, but I do believe that the court made its finding clear that it did find that the privacy harm and unwarranted adverse consequences to Mr. Clark did greatly outweigh any public interest. So I think that that's already been done.
Mr. Muggy, would you agree that at least on its face, the exception would seem to apply here, on its face?
On its face, it would apply to the initial mistaken charge, the class 2 traffic misdemeanor. But on its face, it does not apply to the class 3 false reporting charge that was brought under the criminal code. And therein lies the dilemma. The statute does not provide us any guidance on the interplay between the two. I'd agree with the court that if this was strictly a class 2 traffic misdemeanor case, the statute is clear. But this is not. And that's where we're left to give the trial court some guidance. The trial court begged for some guidance, and this case is ripe to provide that sort of guidance to trial courts faced with these scenarios.
Counsel, it seems curious to me that we are, at least the parties seem to be casting some gloss on the meaning of the statutory phrase pertaining to by reference to what actually happens as a practical matter with sealing. So let me ask you, tell me what, in your mind, what happens when a court says, okay, the records are sealed? What physically takes place?
It's my understanding that the an order is issued to records custodians, whomever they may be, and they have to review the records and redact and seal any of the information on the actual charges. Now, the statute makes clear that they cannot seal or redact basic identification information, which is quite extensive on what that includes, you know, name, photograph, date of birth, place of birth, employment, aliases, fingerprints, photographs. It's quite a laundry list of things that are not sealed. But as far as any information relating to the actual charge itself, that's to be sealed.
How is it sealed? Do they wrap it up in tape, or what does that mean, sealed?
I'm not sure that there's a uniform procedure for every state agency, but it's my understanding that those files are removed from wherever they keep the public files into a separate area, and the actual original records themselves are not altered in any way, because that's actually forbidden by the statute.
So if a member of the public comes up and wants to see the file in such and such a case, even if the records are sealed, there will be a file that contains the defendant's name and identifying information, that kind of thing, in that file.
The basic identification information,
will there be a case number?
But that's it. I'm not sure about the case number. I think not. That's not mentioned in the basic identification information. So I think it's pretty black and white on what is and what is not included.
Thank you.
Mr. Muggy, relating to that last question, you have an alternative argument that there should be partial sealing here. How would that work physically on the documents? I mean, you've got some documents that are going to end up referencing all the charges. I mean, how is that going to work?
Well, let me be clear that that's our second alternative. I still believe that the whole sealing is the better approach here and is more consistent with our rules of statutory construction and the legislature's intent. But the fallback on this partial sealing would work much in the same way that I believe the system works now. Any records custodian right now has to go through these records to ensure that they're not sealing or otherwise redacting the basic identification information, which, as we just discussed, is quite extensive. So I envision it working in the same manner, really. So the two issues then are, which interpretation do we choose? And we know we have to choose one. I believe the trial court's interpretation is very rigid, does not give harmonious, sensible effect to the statute as a whole. Rather, it allows these narrow exceptions to swallow the entire rule. And we know, based on all of our judicial authority, that that is to be avoided in these sort of statutory constructions. But that's precisely what's happened in this case. And as we just discussed, there are two much better alternatives that are consistent with our rules of statutory construction and give life to the legislature's public policy goal, which is to protect its citizens in cases exactly like this, when someone's livelihood is potentially ruined because of two minor charges. You know, if this happened to me as a member of the bar, it wouldn't be an issue. But because Mr. Clark is subject to heightened security, to heightened security industry regulations, it's become, it's had disastrous consequences. This is a case precisely that the legislature had in mind, to allow Mr. Clark to seal those records, to avoid the public scrutiny from clients, from potential employers, on two charges, like I said, that have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with his performance as a securities broker. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman and I represent the people in this matter. As just an initial point, I just wanted to talk about the petitioner's contention that this was a mistaken traffic offense charge. And I disagree. I think I've explained that somewhat in the brief, which is the charge seems to fit a complicity theory that that the petitioner was actually properly charged with a failure to report or falsely reporting under the traffic charge. I know in the reply brief, my opponent has argued that complicity wasn't charged, and there don't seem to be any cases under the complicity statute that's in the traffic offenses, But I would analogize to the complicity statute under the regular felony charges, which is complicity is a theory. It's not an offense or a charge. It's unnecessary to charge it as a separate offense. So certainly they could have pursued this under a complicity theory. And I think, Judge Terry, your points were well taken, which is at the time of the encounter with the officer, this obviously seemed to be an appropriate charge. Obviously, I wasn't there for the trial court proceedings in this matter, but, you know, everyone uses the language sort of freely that this was the wrong charge, and that's been carried out to mean this was a mistaken charge, it should have never been charged. I would read that under the circumstances as saying this was actually the charge that he pled to, and I think it was part of a plea bargain, was the more appropriate charge for this offense, but not that the one that was originally charged was in any way improper or mistaken or unfounded. I also think that there's on page 5 of the answer brief at the bottom is a block quote from the prosecutor during the sealing proceeding, in which I think they talk about how this was in fact a proper, that the act supported the original charge. So that position was made in the sealing case below, and again, I think the record, what we have, supports that. I guess I would talk briefly about what I think is the petitioner's best argument. And the best argument to me seems to be that because he was allowed in the plea bargain to plead to something that was a non-traffic offense and then later withdraw that this has converted this from being a traffic offense record under the statute into something different that would be subject to a sealing petition. And I'll explain why I think that's incorrect. First of all, I guess the basic principles of statutory construction we're all familiar with is we look to the plain language of the statute to discern the intent of the legislature, and the purpose of construing a statute is to give effect to that intent, if possible, and not to adopt a position that would undermine that obvious purpose of the statute. I think both sides agree that the statute is essentially about the balancing, as we know, of public interest and private interests in determining whether a record should be sealed. This particular exception, the traffic offense exception, I think recognizes that there's a part of the public interest is in the courts not being inundated with traffic offense sealing petitions. And so that's part of the legislative intent here. And I think the petitioner's position ultimately will undermine that approach because what will ultimately happen is that the trial courts will have to look at every petition in a traffic record sealing case to determine whether it contains something that's not a traffic offense and thereby parse out which parts are, whether it constitutes a traffic record, whether it doesn't, and whether that requires sealing or not, I'm gonna leap a little bit ahead of myself, but I think under the petitioner's approach, the only argument that he could, if assuming he's right, somehow this converts his record, and he's entitled to seal it, I think under this plain statutory language, he could not seal the part that would relate to a traffic offense. The language is black and white on that point.
So, Mr. Holman, let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say a defendant's charged with vehicular homicide, felony, non-traffic offense, and incidentally is charged with a traffic offense.
Sure.
Would you say that the exception applies in that circumstance? Don't we have a tail wagging the dog kind of situation?
Well, and you know, that's an interesting question. And when I was preparing for argument, I thought about what sort of this aspect of this is, what makes something a traffic, a record pertaining to a traffic offense. And I would hypothetically agree that in a case where at the outset, the petitioner is charged with a vehicular homicide and there's also an underlying traffic offense, that there's a good argument that at least part of that record, but probably maybe all of it, is not a traffic offense record, that what's contemplated is actually a case like this one, skipping the aberrations that arise, which is it's charged as a traffic